I am me. I am who I am. I am who I'm gonna be. Walking in the spirit, moment by moment, fulfilling my own destiny. I am me. I am who I am. I am who I'm gonna be. Walking in the spirit, moment by moment, fulfilling my own destiny.
Hello there, everybody. Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever you are. Today is Monday, October 28th. My, oh my, the month is just flying by, isn't it? We are getting into the fall weather here in Wisconsin, that's for sure. We actually had snow fly earlier last week, so it was definitely interesting. Not measurable, but just the white stuff enough to be visible. But today, you are listening to Purpose Talk Radio, and I am Cindy Freeman, your host. And our guest today is Mark Riccobono. And we will be talking about transforming dreams into reality, the hopes of one, and the power of many. And part of why I've got Mark on the show today, well, let me do some housekeeping stuff here first, and then we'll get into that. But what we have today, the song that you just heard, the theme song for Purpose Talk Radio, is I Am Who I Am. It's by the group True Trinity. The writers of that would be Jillian Clark, Rachel Martinez, and myself. And you can find out more about that group as well as the music at TrueTrinity.com, TrueTrinity.com. And they're also on Facebook. If you'd like to connect with them there, you're welcome to do that. Of course, each week the show does air noon Pacific time, 2 o'clock Central, 3 o'clock Eastern, and 8 o'clock UK time. So I welcome you in the various time zones to this wonderful land of soul, spiritual, purpose living. If you'd like to learn more about Purpose Talk Radio, here's some live shows, learn about our guests, the ones that are upcoming or the ones that have been on the show in the past. You can do that at PurposeTalkRadio.com. Of course, PurposeTalk. RADIO.com. And also at that link, you can sponsor the show or offer a donation if you'd like to keep us on the air for a couple of hours instead of going down to a half-hour show, which would be another option for us. But we'd like to stay on the air and keep our guests busy and able to have you call in. So you're welcome to connect with us there. If you wish to reach me, you can do so at cindy@purposetalkradio.com. So let's see. The other things we should tell you is that we are also looking for guests. If you'd like to be a guest on our show, please leave me a message as well. There are opportunities. We do have the schedule filled until the middle of November. But beyond that, we'd love to have you on. If you have a purpose that you have determined to be your life, you are now living it, and you'd like to share with others how you got there and how they might be able to get to that same place in their life, we'd love to have you interview and be part of our discussion here on Purpose Talk Radio. And let's see, what other things can I tell you today that you might be interested in? Today, part of why I've got Mark on the show today is that it is the end of Meet the Blind Month. And, you know, not everybody does have the opportunity to meet blind folks. And when they do, they don't know what they're supposed to act, how they're supposed to say or do things. I myself had my own challenges with the vision and the eyesight, not with the vision. I never had a problem with the vision. That's a good thing. But I did have a problem with the eyesight. And what I learned is that sometimes people came up to me and wanted to shout. They thought that I couldn't hear them. Well, of course, that's not the case. Eyesight and hearing loss are two totally different things. And, you know, I work in both fields as I am an interpreting student for sign language, and as well as, like I said, I've had the eyesight issues over the years. And it's funny how the two cross, and yet that people don't always understand the difference in them. So what we'd like to do is introduce you to some of the maybe shoulds and should nots regarding folks that do have visual difficulties, as well as let you learn about Mark and what he has been able to do as essentially a person and what he's been able to do as a blind person as well. So I am going to bring Mark into the air as I also introduce him to you. Mark, do we have you on the air at this point?
Here I am.
Hello, hello. Well, let me tell you a little bit about Mark. He was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, right where I'm from, and I got to meet his mom through the National Federation of the Blind. So that's how I got to hear more about him, and also when I went to a national convention in Texas several years ago. The name Mark Riccobono kept coming up as someone who has really succeeded in his life and done what he wants to do and move forward. But Mark was diagnosed with glaucoma and aniridia at age 5, and I'll let him explain exactly what that is, but basically, over time, it meant that he lost his eyesight. Nonetheless, he was able to attend public schools. He graduated with honors while active in debate and track. Mark earned a bachelor's degree in business administration at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He became a member of its Iron Cross Honor Society and was the founding president of the Wisconsin Association of Blind Students. Now, that organization, what that does is it helps college students, college-age students, and it might, now I'll let Mark talk about that too. I don't know if it helps high school students also, but college students learn to maneuver around a college campus and to get the accommodations they need, as well as to live independently as college students. A lot of times for them, it's their first time away from home. So it helps with them as well, and discussions, and have colleagues that they can rely on. But also during Mark's senior year of college, he was elected president of the National Federation of the Blind of Wisconsin. After graduation, Mark joined the SEERS Executive Training Program, spent his free time advocating for the blind. Then he was appointed to the Wisconsin State Superintendent's Blind and Visually Impaired Education Council and made the first director of the Wisconsin Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired, an agency responsible for statewide services to blind children. Afterward, he took a position in Baltimore with the National Federation of Blind, earned a Master's of Science in Educational Studies from the Johns Hopkins School of Professional Studies in Business and Education. And again, let me stress that, a Master's of Science. Again, no small feat for a sighted person, let alone someone who has visual difficulties. But Mark is currently the executive director of the NFB Jernigan Institution, the only research and training institute developed and directed by the blind. Mark's duties are diverse and complex. He generally describes them as simply synthesizing the hopes and dreams of the blind into imaginative programs that advance opportunities and expand the possibilities. He's charged with understanding where the blinds want to go and figuring out how to get there, even if the resources do not exist today. And one of the things that really impressed me is in January 2011 at the Daytona International Speedway, Mark navigated a car equipped with non-visual technology for 1.5 miles, demonstrating the first time a blind individual has driven a street vehicle in public without assistance of a sighted person. And one of the things I got to experience while I was at that National Federation meeting just before that was how some of that technology works, and it was amazing. And for those of us that, you know, think we don't have with our sight is that we lose our independence and the ability to drive, when that car really becomes reality for us, it's going to be, you know, a whole different world. But anyway, in the early 2011, University of Wisconsin alumni recognized Mark for his accomplishments by naming him as one of their Forward Under 40 Award recipients. In 2010-11, Mark served as an appointed member of the Commission on Accessible Instructional Materials in Post-Secondary Education. Again, something that's fairly new to blind folks. Of course, Mark is married to Melissa, who is the president of the NFB of Maryland. They have three children, Austin, Oriana, and Elizabeth. Boy, that says a lot, Mark. It definitely shows how, you know, you have moved forward in spite of, quote-unquote, what people think would be obstacles. And it didn't stop you.
There you go.
So I guess what I'm going to touch on several pieces of this, but first I'd like to say, how did you know originally, you know, one of the missions of this show is to have people look at and explain how they knew what they were supposed to do in their life. So I want to start with that. And where did your dream come from that you finally been able to be reality?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to participate in this program, and pleased to be talking to you from the National Federation of the Blind Jernigan Institute here in Baltimore. So, well, you know, the truth of the matter is I didn't know what my dreams were until I met blind people in the National Federation of the Blind. Before that time, I didn't really actually know I was a blind person. I knew I couldn't see well, but I was very much used to pretending as though I could see stuff because I knew I got the message, not always directly, mostly indirectly, from society, sometimes educators, sometimes other people, that seeing stuff was important and that vision was important to be successful. And so I learned to fake it. And I like to say that I was really a passenger in my own life. I did the things that I thought you were supposed to do, not because they were the things I wanted to do, because they were the things I thought you were supposed to do in order to be considered successful. Although they might not have been exactly the things that were in my heart to do, but I didn't really know what was in my heart to do because I didn't know really what the possibilities were for me. I didn't know what the possibilities would be to have a family, to be successful in the adventures and employment that I wanted to pursue. And I sort of followed the path that I thought was the one you were supposed to follow. And fortunately for me, my parents taught me to work hard, and I was smart enough to get by. And really getting by is what I was doing until I met the National Federation of the Blind and I went to our annual convention in Anaheim, California in 1996. I was about to go into my junior year at the University of Wisconsin, which is when I was going to start taking classes in the business school. And I met a bunch of blind people who were running circles around me. They were going places with purpose. They didn't consider it a problem that they were blind. They were figuring out how to do the things they wanted to do. They were speculating about how the world should be and how they could be a part of it and how they could do things that they hadn't thought about doing before and how to build technologies if they were necessary. And I met people who were working in all walks of life, and they were doing it not because someone told them a blind person could do it, but because that's where their heart was. And they started telling me, although they didn't know me, they put their arm around me and said, you know, you can do better than this. You got to stop pretending like you can see and start being who you are and learn the skills that blind people use to be successful. And that set me on a road I like to describe as really moving from being a passenger in my own life to being a driver. And I started to figure out what was it that I wanted to do and where did I think I could contribute. Now, I had to learn how to be in the world as a blind person. I had to learn Braille. I had never been taught Braille in school. And so I taught found a blind person in Madison, Wisconsin, who taught me Braille. And I started using Braille in my classes, and I was using the long white cane, and for the first time really traveling around with confidence and purpose. And I found that one of the ways to discover who I was and where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do was to start giving back to other blind people. So I started teaching some of the things I had learned from the National Federation of the Blind to other people, other blind people and other sighted people who didn't understand blindness. And I figured out in that process what was I really passionate about. And I learned in the process that I was really passionate about education, probably because in some ways my education was so awful that I knew there had to be something different done, that there really were possibilities to inspire and engage blind young people, and I wanted to be a part of that. And so I started advocating, throwing in ideas, learning about education, and as you mentioned, I was hired to be the director of the Wisconsin Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired in the year 2000, after it was reorganized. So I was the first director of that new state agency in Wisconsin. And that really is when I figured out that part of what I like to do is figure out how to bring the right resources together with the right people who are passionate about getting something done, and a different way of thinking about the possibilities for blind people, and figure out how to put it all together in a way that makes things happen that really have never happened before, because no one's imagined that it was possible. So not necessarily doing anything real magical, except that starting from a basis of believing in blind people, having an unshakable faith that blindness is not the biggest barrier that blind people face, but really it's the societal attitudes and oftentimes the how the world is constructed because of those attitudes that stand in our way. So as an example, when I have people come to the Jernigan Institute here in Baltimore, which is the headquarters of the National Federation of the Blind, we have sighted leaders from around the community that come visit our building and learn about us all the time, and I tell them that we provide a very, very expensive accommodation to our sighted employees. It's one of the most expensive things we do, but we provide lights because we believe that you know, they haven't been trained, our employees, to how to function in the dark competently, and they need the lights to be accommodated, and we think it's important that they be able to compete on terms of equality and use their own talents. And this is the first time that people get the idea that it's not necessarily about accommodating, it's about how the world is constructed and whether or not you have the skills to live in it. The lights we provide here at the National Federation of the Blind are certainly more expensive than this little Braille display I have sitting in front of me. Certainly over time, much more expensive. So, but we don't think about it, and the lights aren't thought about because they're so prevalent in society, but the Braille display is seen as different, and so it's thought of as being a special sort of accommodation, and we want the world to be different than that. So I figured out that that's really where my heart was figuring out what blind people wanted to do that we weren't doing, and then figure out how to really take the passion, the energy, imagination that blind people have, bring partners into the process and build interesting programs. And that's part of the reason that I came to work at the National Federation of the Blind shortly before we opened the Jernigan Institute, because I wanted to be on the cutting edge of building programs that were based on the hopes and dreams of blind people, and really be a part of the family that is the National Federation of the Blind. The impressive thing about what I get to do is that the National Federation of the Blind is an organization of blind people. It's blind people speaking for themselves, determining for themselves where they want to go, what they want to do. And it's not an organization that is made up of people that think that what needs to happen is people need to provide charity and pity to the blind. And so we get to do fun stuff that no one else in the world is doing, like build educational programs where kids get to launch real NASA rockets or build innovative technologies that empower blind people to do things that they've never done before. So one of the things I've learned in that process is that there actually aren't any limits for blind people. I used to think that there were limits to what we could do. We had to be reasonable about what the potential was, where we could go. But what I've learned, particularly in the last 5 years since we built a car that a blind person could drive, was that actually we're only limited by our own imagination and our own misconceptions. And if we continue to challenge each other to figure out new solutions to get access to information, that we can innovate great solutions to what we want to do and how we want the world to be. And in the process, we enrich our own lives. That's part of the reason I like to do it, is because my life continues to be better, more dynamic, because I'm challenged to evaluate what I'm doing and not get comfortable with where I am today, but think about how to go to the next thing. So that's kind of how I got to my dream. And the thing about it is, in the process, I get to contribute. I get to learn about other people's dreams. And by learning about their dreams and helping them achieve something they want to do, my dreams become bigger in the process. So I was just out in Montana working with some of our members in Montana at their annual convention. And, living in Montana is different than living in Baltimore City or Milwaukee, which is a very comparably sized city to Baltimore. And they're trying to figure out how to achieve and how to go beyond what the people around them expect. And that's great fun. So one of the other things I would say is that in the process of figuring out what I wanted to do, what my dreams were, I started to surround myself with folks who knew stuff that I didn't know about the world, and found a core of mentors within the National Federation of the Blind who just had experience that I didn't have. And I started to make myself be curious about who they were and what they were doing and how did they get to be where they were, and in the process really expanded my own knowledge about how the world works. And so a lot of times today I tell people I get to carry out all sorts of assignments, not because I've had formal training in doing it, but because I've had enough curiosity to ask people about their work that at least have some ideas about a whole variety of aspects of the world. And I know who to call on if I need help. So, I know blind people who are in the medical profession, or blind people who are lawyers or teachers or counselors or engineers or scientists. And I can call on those people when I need them. And I think that's another tremendous part of fulfilling your own dreams is getting the widest network you can. And in order to get a wide network, you have to be interested in what other people are doing, not just want them to be interested in what you're doing. So hopefully that answers your question, Cindy.
Right. There you go. Wow. A long way around it. But yes, you have been through a lot of things. And I do have to acknowledge there are other organizations that do help blind people. You know, you happen to work for the National Federation of Blind. There are some other ones out there. And we're not, promoting one or the other over it. What we are promoting is that you have been able to do what you wanted to do in the process of all this. So that I don't, offend someone from another organization, just to acknowledge that as well. So, But I want to, so you've got that issue, and that was when you went to your first convention, you were already in college, you've been through all of this, the schooling and the struggles with that, correct?
Yes, yep. Yeah, so...
Okay. So you were, like, in your 20s already?
Yeah, when I first went to the National Federation of the Blind Convention, I was just short of my 20th birthday.
Okay. So, wow. So what was... I'm gonna back way up for you here first. I know a lot of people are familiar with glaucoma, being the pressure in the eye and the things that, you know, if that pressure doesn't get reduced in some way, you know, it doesn't impact the eyesight.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly that's usually associated with people that are older,
mm-hmm.
although I've had it since I was in my teens also. So, it's not always a quote-unquote older disease. Your bio said that you had it at age 5, which seems really, young and out of it. So, you had anorindia also. Would
mm-hmm.
you explain, first of all, what those diseases meant to a 5-year-old, if you can even remember at that point?
Well, I didn't really know what they meant. All I knew is that I couldn't see so well, or at least not as well as other people. So, I didn't really have a frame of reference to know. Maybe it's that it didn't matter. I don't think it would have mattered much, really. I knew that I had to go in often and get my pressure checked, and I knew that every time I was there, some other resident would be brought in to look at me because I was kind of a rare specimen. And partly that gave me the idea that I was sort of special and not like anybody else in the world. And that can be a good or bad thing, but I didn't know any other blind people. I never met another blind person until I was in high school, and that was a real disadvantage because I didn't have any mentors. I didn't know that there were other blind people out there living life every day. I didn't know that there were adults that I could look up to that also were dealing with blindness. So, as a child, as I say, I really learned to pretend as though I could see more than I could because I didn't know there was another way to think about the world.
Okay. So when did you actually lose the eyesight significantly enough that it really started to impact your life?
Well, that's a hard thing to answer. I started using large print books in third grade. By fifth grade, I couldn't read the large print books anymore, so I started reading them with significant magnification. Certainly at that point, I should have been learning Braille probably before that. So when did it start to be significant? Well, I don't know. It was probably significant from kindergarten in some ways. It wouldn't have been as significant had I had had real educational training in how to do the things I wanted to do or needed to do in school as a blind person, would have really minimized the impact that it had on my life.
Can you elaborate on that a little more?
Sure, absolutely. So, as I say, I didn't learn Braille. So I was never taught Braille. So I had to memorize pretty much everything I could to get by in school. And that works to some degree. But mostly what happens is you learn to memorize stuff for the test, and then after that you really haven't synthesized the knowledge. So I missed a lot of significant learning opportunities because, I was just trying to get by and survive in the classes that I was in. Also, you know, because I was trying to pass as though I could see, I stayed out of a lot of opportunities that I might have gotten involved in had I understood that it was respectable to be blind and that, you know, my participation didn't have to be limited by my blindness. So I stayed away from doing stuff. I didn't really get involved in sports or gym that much because I didn't really know how to do the things I needed to do as a blind person. And when I tried to do them, they were embarrassing. You know, I remember in sixth grade when I our class was doing a football skills unit, and what we were supposed to do was run a U-shaped pattern and catch the football at the peak of the U, and I understood what a U looked like, and I understood that the football was coming my way, but I'd run and I'd throw my hands up, but I had no chance of catching the ball because I could never see the ball, and there was no thought about doing anything different, except that the gym teacher told me not to worry about it because someday I would get contacts and everything would be okay. So the orientation always was that vision was required and for success, and that someday maybe there'd be a possibility of making my vision better rather than really helping me gain the skills and confidence where I was at that moment. And, of course, as you get into middle school and certainly into high school, that impacts your socialization, right? Because I didn't have the confidence to really socialize with my sighted peers because I was trying to pretend like I could see, but I really couldn't. So I just shied away from those social opportunities. And that's where I say that the National Federation of the Blind really made a difference for me. And in fact, I do think that really I credit my mentors, friends, colleagues in the National Federation of the Blind for really helping me understand that there was a different way to go about the world. So I learned Braille and I started to have the study skills that I really needed to be competent and confident. I started to travel with the long white cane, and not just travel with the long white cane, but understand that I could go the places I wanted to go, and I could be comfortable not always having all the details worked out, because, of course, there are sighted folks that get lost too. And because I didn't have to fake like I could see stuff anymore, I didn't have a problem going the places I wanted to go, because what I would do before is if I knew I was going to get into a situation where I couldn't see very well, I'd just avoid going there. And when I stopped worrying about that and all that emotional stress around that, I was free to go do stuff that I wanted to do. So I decided after my junior year at the University of Wisconsin that I wanted to get involved in the sailing program at the university. And they hadn't had many blind people, if any, in the sailing program. I started going to the sailing program and figuring out how to sail by myself and working with folks. And I wouldn't have had the confidence to do that had I not met other blind people who shared their dreams and what they were doing. So at a very practical level, I started really learning the skills of how to do things as a blind person. And then challenging myself, because I had some people around me that were supportive, to kind of go beyond my comfort zone and expand my horizons.
So then, okay, so then you get through, did you go to any of the training institutes and things like that that are offered, or the schools, or did they even exist at that point?
Well, as I say, I learned Braille over the summer from a blind person in Madison, Wisconsin. When I graduated from college, I thought I was doing pretty good. I had a job lined up at Sears, and some friends of mine from Colorado said, well, you got some time before your job starts. Why don't you come get some training at the Colorado Center for the Blind? And I couldn't think up a reason to say no. But I thought I had a lot of the skill stuff figured out. And so I went for training at the Colorado Center for the Blind. And I actually figured out that there was a bunch of stuff I didn't have figured out. Part of it was the real internal confidence to travel competently in the world. Of course, at the Colorado Center for the Blind, I learned to travel under blindfold. I still had a little bit of vision, and I over-relied on it because, you know, I was used to doing that. I was used to faking it for so long. I didn't really know what I didn't see because I was so used to faking it. So I had to go learn to travel under blindfold, and that really gave me confidence in those non-visual skills. I started to learn that actually the degree to which I could or couldn't see wasn't the thing that mattered, and got into other, you know, activities, challenge activities like rock climbing, which gave me sort of a different perspective on how to push myself to kind of get beyond some of the mental barriers that we have about our fears of this and that thing. And then how to really do a lot of the daily living skills as a blind person, you know, cooking, grilling, using power tools, really getting good using non-visual access technology, and, of course, really sharpening my braille. The real thing that I gained was the very tough internal understanding, the confidence that vision was not a requirement for success in my life. You know, for many, many years I had had that understanding. It was ingrained in who I was. It was part of who I was. Even if I was outwardly a little bit confident, I still, in my heart, had the idea that for some things, vision was required. And my training at the Colorado Center really got the notion across that that wasn't true, that I could figure out ways to do the things I wanted to do and go the places I wanted to go as a blind person. And that's been a guidepost really for my life, how I tackle the challenges that I face, even to some degree the discrimination that I still face as a blind person.
What do you mean by discrimination?
Well, you know,
I mean, I know that's kind of a simple question, but it's not really, because some people think, oh no, you know, blind people need to be protected or coddled,
yeah,
or whatever, and you know that I'm figuring that's probably what you're referring to, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so there's a couple different dynamics to it. The first is we don't have enough blind people out in the world who have yet changed society's perception that blindness is in fact not equivalent to incapacity. The average person on the street, when they see a blind person, thinks, here's someone I need to help. And if there was a basic level of dignity, the same basic level of dignity you should give to any person on the street that you see, that would be fine. But it expresses itself, and a lot of times it's well-meaning, but it expresses itself in ways that actually have the potential to teach blind people that, you know, that they should be dependent on other people to do what they want to do and go where they want to go. So just as an example, I travel through airports all the time. I have been in something like 9 different airports over the last 6 weeks. And when I step into the airport, almost instantly somebody grabs me. They don't talk to me first. They run up and they grab me. Now, they wouldn't do that to a sighted person. In fact, if they did that to a sighted person, they'd be in danger of being smacked. And that's the temptation I sometimes have, I admit, because I expect to be treated with the same basic dignity. If you want to offer me help, that's fine. But when people start tugging on my suit or grabbing my suitcase without saying anything, or maybe worse than that, starting to grab my cane so they theoretically can lead me around, I think, you know, you're not treating me with the basic level of dignity and respect that every person deserves. The other thing that often happens is when someone does offer help and you say, no, thank you, I'm fine, and got it, they say to me, are you sure? You know, I don't have the right to say no. They can't imagine how I wouldn't want help. And I give the airport because it's the one of the places where this happens the most, maybe because I spend a lot of time in airports. And you take getting onto an airplane. Almost every airplane you get onto, it's the same drill. You go down the jetway. It's a straight shot, sometimes at slight angle, and you go to the left to get on the airplane. I can't think of one time I've ever gone right to get on an airplane. And when you get on the airplane, almost universally, you go right when you get on the air. I mean, there's only one aisle. You know, it's not that difficult. But people want to fall all over themselves to guide you down, and then, you know, they want you to wait for a wheelchair before you get off the plane, and it's just not necessary, right?
Thing I found out, the wheelchair. It's like, it's not like my legs are broken or anything else. It's, you know, just my eyesight isn't working the way yours is. I can walk. I can move. I can carry my luggage. I can wheel my luggage, all that kind of thing. But, yeah, I agree with you. That was one of those strange things I couldn't understand.
So as a blind person in the airport, you know, we're pretty much treated at the level of luggage. And people would say, well, no, come on, you're exaggerating. But it is true. And that's because society doesn't, they don't see enough positive images of blind people, and the general society doesn't really believe in the capacity of blind people. They don't have enough experience with blindness. And it expresses itself in other ways as well. So, you know, for example, government websites, in theory, should be accessible to everybody. But many of them are not. So we don't have equal access to public information, commerce, that sort of thing, because websites aren't built with accessibility in mind. Now, we know how to build websites with accessibility. It's not hard. There are great standards out there, but a lot of times they're not. And so that means when I want to go to take my son to Six Flags here in Maryland, if you buy an online ticket in advance, it's $39.95. But the online system is a flash system, which is not accessible. So when I show up, I got to pay $56.95 or potentially even worse, $65.95, only because I'm blind and because they built a website that's not accessible to me. That is discrimination. And especially in a case where we know that a website can be built to be accessible. So one of the interesting things that's happening with technology is we're actually changing the paradigm of how blind people get access to stuff. You know, whereas before we've been content with having specialized books from the Library of Congress and the Books for the Blind program and having only 1% or maybe 2% of all the books that are published in the world on a yearly basis or in the U.S. on a yearly basis. Now we're saying, well, no, actually we want access to all the electronic books and we'll pay for them, but sell us the books in an accessible format. And of course, digital is not inherently visual. It's ones and zeros. It's just about the way you design it. And so now we have iBooks and Blio and formats like that that are fully accessible, and we can buy the same book at the same time as everybody else. And so the world being constructed in a way that's discriminatory is also changing. But there still is a lot of discrimination. I mean, as a blind parent, I have to worry about, is someone going to see my wife and I, who are both blind with our kids, and decide to call social services because they can't imagine how a blind, how a kid would be safe in the custody of blind parents. And some people would say, oh, come on, you're exaggerating. But I can tell you that in the state of Maryland, in the last year, we have had two incidences that we know of where children have been taken from blind parents for a period of time just because of the notion that here's a blind person and I can't imagine how they would raise this kid, because in both those cases there was no basis and no basis found for taking the children other than disability. And we actually passed a law in Maryland to prevent that, and that still happens. So there, the discrimination does exist, and a lot of times it's because people view blind people as being inferior to the rest of society.
Yeah. So let me back up just a little bit. At the airport, they say, unfortunately, they command most often that we sit in wheelchairs, which is just, again, just strange, but okay. So what would be your preference? What would you like people to do as they approach you? How should people act, quote-unquote, as much as they can?
Well, you know, I'd like people to address me in the way that they address everybody else rather than saying, you know, grabbing me and saying something like, where are you trying to go, which is frequently what I get. You know, I'd like the same level of dignity that's afforded everybody else. Hey, how you doing? Can I help you with anything? And if I say yes, you know, I would expect a level of dignity. And if I say no, I want the ability to go on my way without having someone being so worried that I certainly can't mean what I said, that they continue to harass me about, well, are you sure you don't need help? I mean, I've had, you know, 3 and 4 times this goes on. And that's not a level of dignity that you want. Now, there are times that I want information or want help. You know, sometimes I ask people, what gate am I at, or which way is the security? And I would love for people to simply answer my question and listen to what I say to them. And if I request help, to, you know, give me the help I need or have asked for, not the help they think I need. So a lot of times, if I say, well, you know, I'd just like some directions to this or that, they say, well, just wait here, we'll get someone to take you. Well, you know, that's offensive. I mean, if I didn't ask for that, don't presume I need it. And if you don't feel you're skilled to give direction, just say that. You know, I don't expect, I meet a lot of people that don't know their right from their left, so at least they can't verbalize it, right? So, fine. You know, let's treat each other with the same dignity and respect that we all deserve. And, if someone wants help, that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. I just want to be able, when I say no, to have it mean no. Because, you know, if I went up to people and started grabbing them and didn't listen to, I mean, they would throw me out, you know. So I want that same level of decency. And I guess the other thing is I'd like to get to the point where people don't think I'm amazing. Got off the plane the other day. I happened this time to be traveling with one of my colleagues. And the guy, I think it was the guy that was in front of me as we were walking off the plane, stopped, and my colleague and I were chatting about where we were going to go and what we were going to do next. And he stopped and asked if we needed anything, and we both said no. Now, she happened to be sighted, and I happened to be blind. And then the guy turned to me and said, well, you're amazing. And I told him he was too. I didn't have any more basis to tell him he was amazing than he had to tell me. Amazing is a pretty high standard, at least in my book. You know, firefighters are amazing. Members of the military are amazing that they put themselves in harm's way for us. There's lots of people that are amazing, but I'm just an average guy walking through an airport. This is not amazing, you know? So I think it's that basic dignity.
Right. You know, and for me, too, it's the same kind of thing that, you know, all of my guests on my show are amazing to me. They have done things that I couldn't fathom doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or that maybe I've done a piece of or dreamed of. And, you know, I want to know how they got where they got and how they did what they're doing and, you know, all those kinds of things. So, you know, it is kind of interesting. And, you know, I built you up on the show. But, you know what, I did it exactly the same way as I've done everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, last week, like my guest last week, Joy, was just like, I'd heard some stuff about her on Facebook, and I talked to her, you know, and the more I talked to her on the show, the more she blew me away as to what she does and what she's been doing in life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I get that with everybody, and it's just so cool when just we recognize that everybody's got their own skills, their own path, and I say this on almost every show, we've all got our own path, our own destiny to be traveling, and we just have to learn what that is sometimes. And
sure.
That's what makes us amazing, is that we are individuals, that we do what we're supposed to do or destined to do and get there however we're supposed to get. And everybody's got their obstacles. That's
right.
The other thing. Blindness
absolutely.
Is any more an obstacle than, you know, domestic violence, than hearing disorders, than a limb being gone, you know, whatever, you know, if the person doesn't allow it to be.
Sure.
You know, that's one of the things I think of and look at. Well, I want to tell our listeners that they can call in. Actually, there's two places that I did not mention at the beginning of the show. We do have the chat open on Purpose Talk Radio Conversations on the Facebook page. So I would invite people to go there and chat. And Sharon Hinckley is over there today moderating the discussion and jotting down some things that are resonating with her of what you're saying today, Mark, as well as what anybody else. Please feel free to chime in over there and participate in the conversation so she isn't too lonely over there. We haven't had a moderator in a few weeks, so it's great to have her on that side. I also have the Blog Talk Radio chat room open. If you are listening through Blog Talk Radio, you're welcome to join us there. But if anyone has any questions for Mark, please feel free to call in. And that number would be 347-205-9074. Again, 347-205-9074. So, what I want to, in a few minutes, I want to talk about the car, because I know that's fascinating to people, but I'm actually trying to convert a file that I can play on the air for us. So I don't want to necessarily get into that right now. But then the other thing that you had, I want to do just a couple of things that I know interest people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yes, I know some of the answers myself, but, you know, so what do you, okay, you know, one of the things I heard you say is you know that it's always left or it's always right when you get on the planes. See, I can't even remember what you said.
Yeah.
You know, let alone to remember to do it. But, you know, you've got that down. You know, how do you know things like colors, color-coding clothes? Because, you know, I've seen some blind people that are better dressed than I am. You know, some simple things, quote-unquote, in life that people take for granted. Could you share just a couple of things that, you know, people might take for granted and how you get through them on a daily basis?
Well, you know, you got to understand, you got to learn about colors and get to know what kind of things go with what kind of other things. And I wear a suit on a daily basis in my work. And so I have tags that I put in my suits that are metal tags. You can sew them right into the fabric. Many of my suits I can tell simply by the texture, the feel of it, that it's a particular suit, so there's not a great need to mark it, although sometimes if I have particular sports coat and particular pants that go with it, then I want to mark them in a similar way that I know they match. And I have far too many ties to talk about, and I have them all marked with numbers, braille, metal tags, and I just keep a braille list based on the numbers, what the ties are, and I can identify them by that. And I have particular ones that I wear more often than others, so I know them better. So pretty simple system. I mean, the key is usually systems to know what goes with what. There are color identifiers out there. I've never felt a great need to have one. And, of course, there are now iPhone applications that are doing a decent job of color identification. So there are more tools out there to give people information about what color something is if they need to do that. And, of course, you know, there's always the tried and true of having folks that you trust, being able to ask them about colors of things and whether it's a suitable color depending on what you're trying to do. And, you know, like anybody else, there are certain people that you trust their judgment in a particular area, and there are certain people that you might not. So if it's clothing, you know, I have certain people that I would trust asking about it, and others that I don't. I would, you know, based on what I know, they wouldn't be my top choice for fashion judgment. And you can get to know a lot of this stuff about colors and that sort of thing when you go to the stores. I mean, you can find the people in the stores that sell the stuff that are much better at talking to you about garments and what goes together and what colors go together and that are passionate about it. And I look for the people that have a passion for it and aren't just trying to sell you something. So that's that. I use a lot of braille around the house. I put braille on almost anything I can. I have an iPhone app that I sometimes use for barcode identification. Although I label a lot of stuff too, I sometimes use the iPhone app to read barcodes. You can read barcodes on anything from canned goods to bottles of wine, which is a very helpful thing. You know, I tend to organize stuff in a way that I can get at it in the future. I digitize a lot of my, if it's a piece of paper that I'm going to need to keep, it's a financial document or something, I put a scanned copy into the computer because I can easily label the file the way I want, put it in a folder that's easily identifiable, and of course, if I need to, can do a global search. And then I always have a printed, a copy that I can print of the document, but I also can convert it in a way where I can read the text out of it. And I do use technology to read a lot of printed documents by scanning them in. And those are the things I readily think of. I mean, a lot of just everyday living is not really that complex. It's just marking things in a way that you have access to the information, whether it's the printed label or the color of the thing.
Well, and again, that's just like anybody else would do. It's like put things in folders, organize, you know, your books in such a way that you can find them. A lot of people alphabetize. You know, you probably do the same types of things.
Yeah.
You know, at work, there's certain file folders. There's certain drawers for things. There's, you know, you have certain supplies in certain closets. So all of that, again, is just, you know, it's a little different, but it still has its similarities to anybody that's sighted. You know, one
yep.
of the things I wanted to stress about that here. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, that's definitely things to work on. Let me, one of the things that I did mention in your bio, too, was about the students. And you touched on it a little bit about the Organization for the Blind Students. that you essentially founded, or you were the founder of it here in Wisconsin. So how does that help students to participate more readily in college, or how does that give them support?
Well, again, where I was at the University of Wisconsin, I found that I didn't have a peer group that was going through some of the same things who I could talk about, what the tools and techniques they were using, and then also where we faced barriers because of lack of access, where we could work together to make improvements. And I started looking for other blind students and wasn't successful in finding any groups that had gotten together. So when I found the National Federation of the Blind, I found that they had a division specifically for students, mostly college students, but not limited to college students. Includes high school students and sometimes younger students. And I went back to Wisconsin and got the blind students I could find together, and we organized a local chapter, and it was a vehicle for us to come together to work on activities, areas that we wanted to improve accessibility, but also share the tips and tricks of how we did various things. And I didn't do a lot of sharing at first. Mostly I took ideas from other people, but after a while started sharing because I knew enough. So what technologies were people using, and how were they managing where there weren't technologies? How do you use a reader as a blind person? Most people aren't used to using a reader. And when you use a reader, you don't want to read from the top of the page to the bottom of the page and all the words in between necessarily, because that's not how sighted people read. They look for headings, and they might read part of a paragraph, and based on what they're looking for or what they're trying to do, they might skip the rest of the paragraph, or they might skip to a particular heading in a document. I had never thought that's how you would use a reader until I started working with other blind students. So we got to share the tools and techniques we were using and learn from each other, but also then collectively work on advocacy issues. So at the University of Wisconsin, as an example, we were working on, at that time, trying to get more accessible technologies into the computer lab, because the ones that were there were pretty old, and there was only one computer, and so if someone was using it, then you couldn't use it, and making sure they were available in a number of different places, not just the library all the way across campus, so you had to trounce all the way across campus, even if, you know, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, that's a pretty big trounce, you know. It's no easy feat. So trying to make sure that there was more accessible technologies in the places that it was needed, or also we worked collectively on raising awareness. So we did outreach where we taught people about Braille and things like that, and that was an advantage to us as students because, again, it got people to know about the things we were doing, the techniques we were using, and it got them comfortable with it, so they didn't think we were some strange species of students. They actually felt comfortable then engaging us in conversations and like we were any other student. So those are some of the things we worked on, and of course we helped to spread the word about the scholarships of the National Federation of the Blind, and we used that as a way to make sure other students knew that there were financial resources out there so they could take advantage of it. And you know, we put together social opportunities so that we could also laugh with each other about the experiences that were frustrating when people didn't expect much from us, or when someone tried to drag us across a street that wasn't a street we wanted to cross. You know, the funny things that happen trying to live life every day when people don't necessarily understand what it's like to be a blind person. So,
right.
And then we expanded that effort into doing some mentoring for younger students because many of us recognized that's something we didn't have. So it was fulfilling to us to do it, and it provided some opportunities that hadn't been there. And we also learned something in the process because the younger students were always getting into things that we didn't have the opportunity to do or experience to do or technologies that we hadn't experienced, and so we enriched our lives in the same way. So we did all those things, but the main thing was, you know, we had an organization that was run by us as blind students, and we got to decide what we wanted to do, what our priorities were. And also in the process, we learned a lot of valuable skills that were later helpful for employment or engagement in society. I mean, we were doing fundraising and organizing, and those skills have been tremendously helpful throughout life in many ways, how to build relationships, and also helpful on the resume. So we got a lot of benefit out of it.
Nice. Well, that's cool. So then again, you were able to incorporate that as you've gone up into the Jernigan Institute and through the NFBI Free Zone, you know, to make sure that those, that upcoming students have some of those same benefits and those same chapters available to them.
Absolutely.
Correct?
Absolutely, yeah.
And then, of course, that they are connected to the quote-unquote, the adult chapters that are available around the United States as well, so that they do have those mentors and those role models in front of them.
Yes, and I think those of us who aren't students anymore, we get a lot of benefit out of those students being organized and doing stuff because, again, they're dealing with stuff on a daily basis that we don't have to deal with. You know, I work a lot on accessibility of technologies in higher education. I don't have to deal with the technologies in higher education on a daily basis, so I need the students out there to, you know, give the lowdown on what it's really like and the barriers that they really face. And I use that as a way of informing both the advocacy work that I do, but also pushing technology manufacturers to really build accessibility in, because in some ways the inaccessible technologies in colleges today, it makes it harder for blind students than when I was a student at the University of Wisconsin 15 years ago, and that's really a shame. I mean, technology should be closing the gap, not making it wider.
Wow, that is interesting for you to say that. You know, I just got myself a smartphone. No smartphone. And it's all touch screen. And it's, yes, the text for me is larger, so it helps for my particular visual impairment. But I can't imagine how a blind person could possibly function with a touch screen. You know, you go the wrong way and you got the wrong numbers punched there, you know, just with a slight, you know, minuscule fraction of an inch. You know, and everything now that I've seen to get a new phone was all touch screen. I couldn't get a normal phone, you know, and I wanted one. I really did. You know, so when you say that the technology is actually getting worse, you know, I look at some of that. I also got a new Mac computer that's got this pad on it instead of a mouse and things that I can maneuver. And if you touch it with two fingers versus one finger accidentally, it sends it off and skyrockets things into places it shouldn't be. You know, so, you know, is the Jernigan Foundation or the NFB involved with, you know, you said something about the advocacy. How does it work to help support some of this technology and getting that changed?
Well, actually, the National Federation of the Blind has led the way on this idea that all technology needs to be accessible out of the box. And in fact, I use a touchscreen device all day, every day, in the Apple iPhone. And that partly came about because of the advocacy work that the Federation did in urging Apple, along with the Massachusetts Attorney General, to make, at that time, the iTunes U service accessible, which was actually pushing educational content from iTunes. So I use the Apple iPhone every day, and it has built-in accessibility. It didn't cost me a penny more. And I can tap things and drag things and do everything I need to do because they built accessibility in from the beginning. And so we're advocating for that sort of built-in accessibility across the board. And we're working with Apple, Google, Microsoft, you name it. We're having conversations with them, both on the technical side in terms of giving them our expertise about non-visual access, because a lot of people think actually that non-visual access, basically the accessibility that totally blind, or not just totally blind, but blind people need, is the hardest thing to do in accessibility. You said it yourself. I can't imagine how a touchscreen is going to be accessible to a blind person. And in many ways, we couldn't either until we started working on pushing this mainstream accessibility. And when you get the best engineers together, you give them the knowledge of how blind people do the things they do, they're going to build innovative technologies. And if they include blind people in the process, it's going to be innovative technology that will be accessible. So we spend a lot of time working on that from an advocacy point of view. Sometimes we file lawsuits if we have to. We do a lot of technical assistance and consultation as well, and we look for partnerships where we can really work hand in hand with these companies to create innovative solutions in this technology space. So there's a lot of touchscreen stuff now. We know how to make touchscreen stuff accessible if it's built right. Doesn't mean that everything should be touchscreen. And there's some interesting stuff coming out that unless we're involved in it, it's going to go the wrong way. I saw the other day for the first time a 100% touchscreen ATM. Now, ATM accessibility has been figured out for a number of years. I'm not sure the company that built the ATM really asked blind people about how they were planning to give blind people the access to the touchscreen part. So it's going to be interesting to see how well it actually works. So it's something we work on all of the time, both from the advocacy point of view and the technology point of view, because we can actually bring real blind people who are going to use the technology to the table to innovate some of these solutions. So we're involved in pretty much every aspect.
Okay. So I think now would be a good time to go into the biggest piece of technology that I know the NFB has been involved in, which is making a car with the combination of Virginia Tech and their, I believe it was their engineering department, mm-hmm. to make a car that a blind person could drive without having a sighted person in the car next to you.
There you go.
So I know, like I said, that was, it was exciting for me, to sit and I'm going to briefly say it and then let you explain in more detail. You know, have gloves on my hands and on the steering wheel. For me, the biggest thing that I lost when I lost the eyesight was my independence, or what I felt, because I had to take a bus and I had to rely on my friends and I had to do this. And when I heard about the car, which to me, being a single person in an apartment before, I could go anywhere, anytime I felt like it, any time of the day, it didn't matter. That was a loss to me. And to hear that this car was in the process, unfortunately cost prohibitive at the moment, but that I'm sure that will change, but that there was a possibility of driving again was just phenomenal to me. And I had to do the simulation just to feel these gloves on my hands that told me how far to turn the wheel and when to brake and when to accelerate. And it was just it was phenomenal. That's all I could say. So I can only imagine. That was a simulation sitting in a seat in front of a screen that somebody else was kind of monitoring. It was kind of a game. It was like a video game at that point. You know, I can only imagine what it would be for you to actually be riding on Daytona 500 track in a car without somebody sitting next to you telling you what to do. So, you know, if you could at all even attempt, and I will play the audio to it, to the actual event. But, you know, what did that feel like? What is some of the technology and some of the stuff that went into the planning of that car?
Well, I mean, let's take one step back, which is to say that mostly even blind people have not believed that it would be possible for blind people to drive. In fact, we in the National Federation of the Blind have said that blind people can compete on terms of equality in any area with the sighted except for driving. At least that's what we used to say. And our president about a decade ago started saying, well, why except for driving? Don't we have capacity? Don't we have the ability to think and react? And isn't this really an access to information problem? The classical way of getting information in the driving environment is to look out the windshield, but why? Does it have to be built that way? Is that the only way to do it? Don't we have an ability to do something, and can't we get together with the brightest engineers and figure it out? And that pattern of thought is different than the rest of the world. Most of the rest of the world takes for granted that, of course, it requires vision to drive a car, and that's it. That's the only way to do it. They can't imagine another way of doing it. We don't think that way in the National Federation of the Blind. We don't think vision is a requirement for success. And until we test the limits, we don't know, so let's get out there and test it. So we got together with this and that university and talked about our idea, and we got together finally with Virginia Tech, and Virginia Tech was the first university to say, yeah, we really want to work on this. We think we can bring some ideas to the table, and they said, we've built cars that drive themselves, and so this is easy. This is just building a car that drives itself. And we said, well, actually, no. We want to be able to drive ourselves. We want to be able to make driving decisions. If you've already built a car that drives itself, then there's no challenge. There's nothing of interest to us. Because that's done. We want to go to a place that hasn't been touched before. And they said, oh, that's not quite what we understood, but sure. So we got together with the engineers. We got some blind engineers. And we started talking about it and going through the process of, well, what do we need to have? And essentially what we've done is leverage the work that has been done in driverless vehicles or autonomous vehicles, vehicles that drive themselves. And we've, rather than having the computer make the driving decision, we've recognized that the same information that the autonomous vehicles use to make driving decisions is the same information that we need blind people to have access to in order to make driving decisions. So we just interrupt the process of the computer. So the computer doesn't make the driving decision, the blind person does. And then it's just an access to information problem. How do you communicate information in a non-visual way? And so you can break down all the driving tasks and into what information do you need, and then what's the best way to deliver it. And so we started with two pieces of information, which are steering and speed, because those are pretty important. And it turns out just with those two, you can do some very dynamic activities. We didn't exactly know all of the how this would play out when we started, but that's innovation. You got to kind of get going on it, and you figure things out, some things out as you go. And we started using some audio stuff, but we figured out that the audio was more distracting, that actually we could communicate a lot of information via vibration. So we built a car. It's basically an autonomous car, a car that could drive itself, but rather than put it in autonomous mode, we're going to send information to the blind person. So we use the same sort of sensors on the outside of the car as some of the autonomous vehicles out there, like Google, that sort of thing. And those sensors gather information about the surrounding environment, obstacles in the way, where the road is. We fuse that data, so that's just a bunch of data points, together with maps, with GPS coordinates, with optical camera data that can recognize where the boundaries are on a road or that sort of thing. And we create this virtual data view of the road and the surrounding environment. Now we communicate steering information to the blind person through a pair of gloves. And the first technologies are what we call instructional. So the computer makes some suggestions about the path that you should drive. And it communicates information about that path to the gloves. For example, if you have a right turn coming up, and if it's a slight right turn, it would vibrate on your right index finger. And if it was a sharp right turn, it would vibrate on your pinky finger to connote a sharper turn was needed. And as you turned, if it was on your pinky finger, the vibrations would sort of step up toward your index finger. And if you turned too far, then you would need to turn back toward the left. It would be vibrating on your left hand. So you kind of need to keep the vibrations between your right and left hand to go straight. Now, it sounds a lot more complex when you describe it. But when you actually get trained on it and you use it for a little while, and I do mean a little while, it actually becomes fairly intuitive. Now, to get real skilled with it, it does take some time, but it sounds a lot more complex than it is. Now we decided for speed, so you really have a speed limit, right? So, I mean, if the speed limit is 20 miles an hour, we said, well, we want to be able to go above the speed limit, but you want to know potentially when you're above the speed limit, and you definitely want to know when you should brake because there's something in your way, or that you might want to slow down because a turn's coming up. And so we, in the seat cushion, built vibrating motors. So if, say, you're going below the speed limit, it's going to vibrate underneath your legs. And if you're going above the speed limit, which you can choose to keep doing, it's going to vibrate on your lower back, which kind of suggests slow down. And it will step up your back as you come to a point where it's just more of an immediate stop. And, again, it sounds more complex than it is, but we got some blind people together, and we tested this technology. We refined it. And, actually, we were able to do some pretty sophisticated maneuvers, avoiding obstacles in the road, avoiding dynamic obstacles, doing a passing maneuver. And we think there's other interface technologies to be built. Now, the first goal here was to get the idea across that maybe blind people aren't as limited as everybody thinks, including blind people. If we use our imagination and we get together innovative thinkers and we put our experience into it, that we can get into stuff that no one had ever expected. And also, this is an opportunity for us to now engage with the driverless car community. Every single car manufacturer is working on driverless cars. Now, they're not going to have driverless cars tomorrow, but if you look at the 2014 vehicles, they're more automated than the 2013 vehicles. Cars are becoming more computer-driven every day. And
We've got military vehicles that travel all by themselves and do what they're supposed to do, programmed in them. You know, you don't have to worry about parallel parking anymore for some driver's test because the car is going to do it all by itself. So
even in those cars, you will still have an access to information problem for a blind person, right? And so our work, it provides us a means to then Now engage with the driverless car community and with the general car community to say, you know, blind people have never been part of the class of drivers. And now we should start thinking about how that's going to happen. Because if all you have to do is interact with the inside of the car, unless that's built to be accessible, blind people still won't have opportunities to drive. And we don't want to just sit in a car that's driving itself, right? We want to be able to query where am I and all the other stuff that people might have access to if they're sighted. So we'll want to be able to do that. And we need to be involved in the process because, again, the engineers out there, they don't think of all the things that we think of. So I've had engineers working on driverless cars say, well, you'll just be able to talk to the car. I say, great. So what if you have laryngitis that day? I guess you can't go to work. What about people that can't speak for whatever reason? Are they shut out? That doesn't make sense. So our involvement in this area, because we now have some experience, will actually create opportunities that weren't imagined before. The real significant thing here is driving is an end goal, but the real thing we want to do is demonstrate that maybe the world isn't as everybody thinks it is. We all believe, including blind people, that we'd never be able to drive. I don't know what the limits are anymore, and it shows that we, if we put our imagination and our energy into it and we open our minds to new ways of thinking about the access to information problem, we can solve a whole bunch of other things. And it also shows that blind people have a lot more capacity than we expected because, or some expected, because we can have build technologies that give them information that actually get them to do complex driving maneuvers.
So, okay, so you wrote on, how long did it take you to train to be on the track?
Well, I mean, that question supposes that the goal was to train to get on the track, and actually my work with the technology was also giving feedback on the technology, so it wasn't just training to do a particular thing. I probably spent 40 hours with this technology, refining the technology, giving feedback on it prior to Daytona.
Okay. That's not really a lot of time in the scope of things.
No, it's not a lot of time. But it actually shows that it doesn't take much effort to that this technology is pretty intuitive. And partly it's intuitive because it's based on our own experience and feedback. So it's not like someone had to think up what blind people needed. We were involved in the development from the beginning, which is really significant.
Right, right. Okay. So on this track, we're going to be able to hear that there were obstacles thrown in your way. There were, you know, it really was a challenge. It wasn't just a drive around the circle. It was probably even more challenging, other than the speed, than the actual Daytona drivers had to experience.
Yeah, and actually, you know, we didn't drive on the oval itself. Daytona has an internal road course, and so we figured that just turning left all the time wasn't particularly interesting. Although we did start at the actual starting line, which is on the banked part of the oval. It's banked at 18 degrees at the starting course, which is actually interesting in and of itself. Driving just on an 18-degree incline is sort of interesting. But it's the internal road course has both right and left turns and horseshoe turns, so it's more dynamic than just going around the oval, actually.
Yeah. And I presume at some point, I'm really going to challenge it, so to speak. You know, I had some of my friends that was actually upset, said, well, now deaf people can drive too. And my reaction was, well, deaf people already are driving. That's part of this issue here. You know, people with prosthetic limbs or limbs missing are able to drive with their cars, you know, especially equipped and all of that. So, you know, but now it's, even with this, I'm hearing that even deafblind people will be able to drive potentially at some point.
Absolutely.
It's not talking. They don't have
absolutely
to talk.
I mean, that's one of the things we would want to make sure, and that's why we're in this space, is, sure, the inside of the car, it's great if the interface is going to talk to you, but how about the ability to hook up a refreshable Braille display so that a deafblind person could participate? Look, again, technology is ones and zeros, and if all we do is think that the visual output is the only way, we're going to miss a whole lot of opportunities to build some interesting stuff. And, of course, if we were building more non-visual interface stuff into cars today, we'd have less accidents. I mean, that's why Maryland and other states are passing laws against texting while driving. Well, if the car companies were using some of the technologies we already have to provide information in a non-visual way, you wouldn't even have to worry about passing the laws.
Right, and Wisconsin just did that last year also, so it's definitely something that's out there. So before I play this video, is there anything else that we should know about this journey you went on?
No, just to say that, you know, I had the privilege of trying to put together the project to build the car, and we had a group of blind people, and the objective was that the best driver was going to represent the National Federation of the Blind at Daytona. So it wasn't, it was really about representing the work we were doing. So I was just fortunate enough to be the person who got that opportunity. But Daytona, I mean, I really had a job to do. So, I mean, if you ask me what the most fun was, well, actually for me it was driving my family around the parking lot the day before. Daytona was a job. It was a very important job, but it was about the greater piece of it. Personally for me, you know, being able to drive my wife and at that time two kids around, that was what was meaningful to me, because that's what this is about, actually being able to raise the expectations for blind Americans and have them participate more fully and exercise the rights and responsibilities to live in the world.
Cool. Well, I'm going to play this video. I tried to convert it into an audio file, but, of course, technology is having the better of me. So hopefully the volume on here will not blast out anybody. But if anybody wants to watch it again or hear it again, I will post it in the Purpose Talk Radio Conversations place on Facebook, and I will also put it in the Blog Talk Radio chat room. So if anybody's interested in watching it and hearing it again, because what has happened is on this video, on the YouTube video, it does have a variety of cameras from a variety of different directions that Mark had rigged into the car. And then it's also got the audio about his, you know, what he was experiencing and all that. So what I'm going to do, Mark, is while I'm doing that, I'm going to put you on hold or mute you so that there's some, you know, external white noise, and we're going to play this and see where we get. So
great.
Thanks. I'll put you on hold here, and then we're going to go to this video and share with you folks exactly what Mark was able to experience that day.
He pats the top of the vehicle with his left hand. He gives a big wave now to the cameramen who are down there, and he is rolling. He is rolling.
Mark Riccobono of the National Federation of the Blind is rolling.
straddling that big double yellow line that we have here at Daytona, which NASCAR drivers know they're not supposed to go below. But here he goes, driving off towards turn one into the infield, and up there, there will be an obstacle slalom course that you can see once he does arrive in that area.
And Kevin, he's not going real slow, really. He's looked like he's doing probably 20, 25 miles an hour, maybe. Nearing the turn one down there, he's now just a car length up on the racing surface above the yellow line, and now it looks like the brake. He hits the brake, turns left, making his way perfectly into what is turn one of the 3.56-mile course here at Daytona. Approaching the first set of barrels, makes his way around those perfectly. Now cuts over the second one, and he's approaching the third set, and he avoids them to the right. A perfect trip through the slalom course.
A perfect slalom course for Mark Riccobono and the National Federation of the Blind. And now, of course, he's got to work his way through the infield. He's going through what is turn two for the Rolex 24 cars. It'll be coming up very shortly. He's got to work his way around and all the way through the International Horseshoe and up to the kink, where we have something very special coming up in a short while. But he's got quite a ways to go. But already, how would you like to go out there? Let's say we put a blindfold on you to do what he has done already here at Daytona. I don't think you'd be very comfortable, but obviously he's done a great job, went right through the slalom and now working his way around in the infield.
It's a vivid demonstration of the capacity and the ingenuity of blind people collaborating with society to change perceptions and create opportunity. That's what today is all about.
Well, Mark now is about halfway to the horseshoe as he continues east toward the International Horseshoe. And he is, very shortly, he will be approaching the stands that are full over there where your group is seated, I'm assuming, Kevin.
Yeah, the purple shirts are going to be giving him a rousing roar. He says he'll honk when he goes by the National Federation of the Blind stands.
Well, I tell you what, he made a perfect apex at the horseshoe, so he is now continuing around that turn. And he's within all 50 yards of that grandstand.
He's coming up to the grandstand, fellow Federationists.
He is there.
Latine.
There he is, Mark Riccobono, the first ever blind driver at Daytona. Dr. Mark Miller said we would do it a decade ago, and we're doing it today.
He has passed the grandstand now and is headed down toward the kink, following that fan that's out in front of him by some 120 yards or so.
By the way, that van has several boxes in the back of it, and shortly, they're going to do what they tell you not to do. Later, they're going to throw those boxes out in front of him.
That's right. I think he teaches his son Austin not to do that. Austin Riccobono's in the house. Don't be littering like your dad and his team.
Well, there comes the first box, and now let's see if Mark avoids it. He does. He passes it on the right. The second box has been deployed, and he passes it on the left. Third box is out. The fourth box is out, and he's perfectly making his way between the two.
So they're throwing boxes out of the back of the van, and the blind driver is avoiding the boxes using this technology.
So he's made it through the slalom. He's made it through the boxes that have come out.
All fun from here.
Once he goes through the Western Horseshoe, we're going to have a moving pass coming up. And what exactly is that?
The plan is for him to be able to actually pass the van. He'll go to the left of the van, the same van that was throwing out the boxes. He'll be able to pass it just like you would do over here at I-4 or whatever. Sometimes they don't let my wife pass, you know, and she gets a little...
Right now, Mark's going a lot faster than sometimes you can go on I-4 as well.
Now I look out, the van is pulled to the inside of the racetrack, and this is where we're getting ready for the moving pass.
And Mark is going to the outside of the racetrack with the van down towards the bottom of the racetrack. And here we come up. He's closing in on the van to make the moving pass.
Well, this is what it's all about, this kind of dynamic display of the capacity and ingenuity of collaboration between the National Federation of the Blind and many in our community. It'll create opportunities for education and employment. It is an historic day, Jim and Larry.
Well, Kevin, he successfully made the pass. 100% complete so far. He has done everything that we expected.
And he's coming up to the finish line. He has made the pass, and he's coming to the finish line.
Makes a perfect turn.
And this is just the beginning. This is the start of it. Over the next decade, we will be looking for university programs and corporations to accept the Blind Driver Challenge and collaborate with us.
He's approaching the end of the run, makes his way in between the barrels that are set up there, and mission accomplished.
We're proud of you, Mark Riccobono. We're proud of the National Federation of the Blind. What a great drive. A great drive at Daytona International Speedway. Thank you so much, Daytona.
Well, congratulations to Mark and Kevin. Thank you for your input. And this has indeed been an historic occasion here at Daytona. And I know Mark is going to be climbing out of that SUV very shortly down there. And he's going to be a happy young man.
Riccobono.
How are you, sir?
Great.
How'd you get here?
Great well, job, Mark. Great job, Mark. How'd you get here? Good job. That was great.
Thank you. Glad you're here.
Our pleasure. That was a great drive. Thank you.
It was fun. Now we've got to get that out of the
barrel. Cash made it right through those barrels. Quite a historic occasion.
Congratulations to you. Congratulations to us.
Very good. How about some of the other folks here? Melissa, come on over
step
here.
Step up.
That would be Mark's wife.
Come on up here. Come on up. Yeah.
Melissa?
Yeah.
All right. That's where you go. Okay.
That's great. Good deal. Yeah. Good deal. All right. Very excited.
Wonderful. So I will bring Mark back on here and... One of the other things is this year, the other phenomenal thing, and I know it's not related to the Federation of Blind, but in August of this year, there was a blind motorcyclist who speeds 167 miles per hour. Now that compared to what you were doing is like, you know, night and day. But again, with the technology, there are things that are able to be done.
You're talking about Dan Parker?
I am.
Well, Dan Parker is a member of the National Federation of the Blind, and his efforts were sponsored by the Federation, so it's as related as you can get.
Actually, no, this one's a Stuart Gunn. But yes,
okay.
The one Dan Parker too. Dan rode on a track too, I believe, similar to yours. But Stuart Gunn was out in Edinburgh, Scotland, actually, this year. He broke a speed record. But then, unfortunately, he said, you know, that his record last year, he originally was riding on the motorcycle 11 years before this, and he broke his back in two places. He broke ribs, his shoulders, he's paralyzed on the right side. So it's a whole lot even more for him, too. But again, the blind ability and the ability of someone, you know, paralyzed that shouldn't, quote-unquote, have been able to do these things. Anybody's able to do anything they want to set their mind to. And that's what this whole show is about all the time, that, you know, we put our minds to it, we look for the resources to be able to get us through, and then we move forward. So I've got about 10 minutes here left on this show, and you were mentioning Dan, so go ahead if you want to talk a little bit more about Dan. That would be great.
Well, Dan Parker's a guy that went blind in a drag race. He was a drag racer, and he hit a wall at 175 miles an hour, and one of the results was that he's now totally blind, and he sat around for a while wondering, what he was going to do with his life, and he always wanted to ride a motorcycle at the Bonneville Salt Flats, and so he started working on that, and the National Federation of the Blind supported his efforts to build a navigation system. Again, the goal was for Dan to do this 100% independently. A lot of times people have had sighted people telling them when to go right and when to go left, and what we know from our experience in the Blind Driver Challenge is that that actually doesn't work as well as when you have control of the information and can react to it instantly. And so Dan and the team built the system. Now, in this case, vibration wasn't going to work because he's riding a motorcycle on the salt flats, and there's already a lot of vibration in it.
Right.
So they used audible tones in his helmet, and he was able to go 55 miles an hour. Now, the goal wasn't to go much faster than that. It was to show that it could be done first, and Dan's going to go back and try to set some other records. They'd never had a blind person race in any of the Bonneville events in this way, and the Bureau of Land Management said to the race organizers that they better cut it out, letting this blind guy drive, because part of the regulation is that anybody driving on the salt flats has to have a valid driver's license. So you see, here's an advocacy thing for us to work on, because there's nothing about driving on this two-mile track in the middle of the Bonneville Salt Flats that requires a driver's license. It's a regulated event. There's not ever for anybody, regardless, more than one person on the track at a time. You don't need a legal driver's license that is the sort of thing that allows you to go on city streets. It's a useless regulation. And frankly, it prevents a lot of people from participating in this stuff that might. So that's where the National Federation of the Blind is important. And Dan's a member of ours, and we've been talking about how to go to the next step on some of this stuff. And that's what's great about what we get to do, is we get to think about, you know, I don't particularly want to go riding a motorcycle. But I've,
that would,
you know,
be a little scary, yeah.
Well, it's just, it's not particularly of interest to me. It's not anything I've... just not, you know, it's not in the wheelhouse of dreams I have. But if I can give my experience to Dan and we can sit and share with each other and put our combined knowledge together, and I can tell him what worked and what didn't work and what we found in our blind driver work, and then he can apply it to what he does, and he's ready to share what he knows with blind people, and we can, by working together, we get a lot farther, and we also expand our thinking on what the possibilities are. So Dan and I have been talking about what kind of racing projects we can put together in the National Federation of the Blind, and maybe could we put together some programs for kids to learn how to ride bikes using non-visual technology.
Nice. That's cool. So... okay, well, there's a lot of things that are still open and open-ended, but, you know, there's a lot of things that are also closing in and making things, life more accessible for the blind, for anybody with any kind of disability, so it's just really cool. We're down to the last couple minutes here. I want to make sure that if anybody does want to reach you, I mean, you can get on the call very quickly if you call in immediately at 347-205-9074, but we are pretty much down to the end of the show. So, Mark, I want to give you a chance to let people know how to reach you, if they'd like to do that.
Well, you can reach me at the National Federation of the Blind Jernigan Institute at 410-659-9314. You can also send email to jernigan institute@nfb.org. That's Jernigan Institute at NFB, as in National Federation of the Blind, .org. And I'd encourage you also, if you send an email to that address, to subscribe to our e-newsletter. Send it out once a month. And it talks about the work that's going on here at the Jernigan Institute and some of the things that we're involved with and ways that you can be involved in the work of the National Federation of the Blind. And, you know, the best way that we can change opportunities is for us to all get together and share our dreams and work on them. And that's why I like to say that it's the dream of one and the power of many, because when we put our efforts together, we get all sorts of interesting stuff out of it. And if you're ever in Baltimore, please come by and visit us at the Jernigan Institute. We're about a mile south of the Inner Harbor, and so we got a lot of cool stuff to show you.
Excellent. And is there anything that we missed today that you wanted to share with anybody?
Well, I think, you know, the only other thing I would add is that there are a lot of it's easy for us to get content with where we are. And unless we have a group of people around us who love us enough to challenge us to do better, it's easy to stay stagnant. It's easy to think that we're doing pretty good, and it's easy to be convinced by other people that we're doing pretty good. I don't know what the real potential of any particular human being is, but I do know that if we have high expectations and we build an environment that expects a lot, we're going to get a lot out of people. And I think we should strive to put ourselves in those sort of environments and with those sort of people. And I would encourage everybody to do that. And I know for me, that environment has meant the organization that I'm in. But I think it's important for people to find that environment and then be part of helping to make it happen.
And that's with everybody. It's got, you know, whether it's sighted or blind or deaf or fully able-bodied or anything else. It's the same thing. You want to find a support system around you that will keep your life being what you want it to be. I you know, that's the way I look at it at this point.
Absolutely.
So, well, Mark, I appreciate your being part of the show today. I'm going to ask you one more time to give that contact information as we close out here, and then I'm going to put you back on hold and close out the show for today.
All right. You can learn more information at nfb.org, and you can send an email to Jernigan Institute, J-E-R-N-I-G-A-N Institute, at nfb.org. Or you can call the NFB Jernigan Institute at 410-659-9314.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, Mark, for being my guest today. I greatly appreciate your time and your efforts on part of the blind people across America and the world at this point, and
great,
being able to offer them opportunities and sharing. Like I said, you know, it has been Meet the Blind Month, so it's a good opportunity for people to get to know what that means, what to do, what not to do in the process of all of this as well, you know, and just understand that blind people are like anybody else. You know, we have our own rights and, you know, quirkiness sometimes and things that we like, don't like, and just the main thing is to respect and just respect people in general. So.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, Cindy. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much for calling in, Mark, and being a part of this.
I'll
put you back in touch. Bye. All right. And thank you all for being a part of this show today. Again, it is October 28th, 2013, and you have been listening to Mark Riccobono, blind gentleman who not only has been able to do and follow his dreams, but also has been able to advocate for blind people, including riding on at the Daytona 500, again, not on the specific track. I've been able to show that blind people can drive a car, too, and at some point, you know, cost, right now it's still cost prohibitive, but at some point they will be able to do that on their own and being a part of, you know, anything else that people want to do. So I thank Mark for being our guest. I thank you for listening to our show. If you'd like to be a guest on our show, learn about past or future guests, or sponsor or donate to Purpose Talk Radio, you can do so by going to our website at PurposeTalkRadio.com. That's PurposeTalkRadio.com. You can reach me directly at Cindy@PurposeTalkRadio.com. Common spelling of C-I-N-D-Y. We do air the show every Monday at noon Pacific time, 3 o'clock Central, or excuse me, 3 o'clock Eastern, and 8 o'clock UK time. So you are welcome to join us, and we appreciate you being a part of it. If you know anyone who would like to be a guest, please feel free to have them call and get a hold and or email and get a hold of us as well. So at this point, I would like to thank you all for listening. I think I did cover everything on this. But again, the biggest part is please respect everybody around you. Don't assume that they need help. Don't assume they don't need help. All we have to do is ask. And that is sighted, blind, anyone else that's a part of your life. Assumptions get us nowhere. All they end up doing is ending up with hurt feelings or hurt emotions or presumptions. And that doesn't get anybody anywhere. Instead, if we just respect each other as who we are and as people, life gets a lot further, and we get a lot further in relationships with each other. So with that, I thank you all for listening, being part of the audience, and being a part of the show. Please go to Purpose Talk Radio Conversations on Facebook if you'd like to chat more, ask any other questions, or be a part of the discussion. Otherwise, we will see you here next Monday, or hear you hopefully. And with that, I close with our song, I Am Who I Am, by True Trinity. Again, you can reach them at TrueTrinity.com. And I wish you all soul blessings.
I am me. I am who I am. I am who I'm gonna be. Walking in the spirit moment by moment, fulfilling my own destiny. I am me. I am who I am. I am who I'm gonna be. Walking in the spirit moment by moment, fulfilling my own destiny. Walking in the spirit moment by moment, fulfilling my own destiny. Walking in the spirit moment by moment, fulfilling my own destiny.